our discussion today will focus on another dimension of Piskei Korona, and that is Nezikin. And we're talking about situations in which people were perhaps guilty, either deliberately or hopefully unintentionally, of causing nezek to someone, or to even more than one person. And our discussion today could be divided up into three parts. First, we're going to talk about unintentional hezek from the perspective of kapara, meaning, do I have to go through an entire process of atonement because unintentionally I was guilty of causing someone's downfall? I'm going to use that term as an ambiguous term. And that's the kapara aspect. Then we get on to monetary payments in the Nezikin. And we can talk about a case where someone actually caused someone else to contract the disease, and what is the scope of his payment or obligation to compensate the nizak, the one who suffered. And finally, we'll get to discussion about someone who's deliberate in causing someone a loss, a financial loss. Now, my nervous tension here is how much I can fit into an hour. And on the one hand, kapara is a major, major part of my discussion today. I found two tshuvas on the issue of kapara, if you cause someone this disease. And I'm fascinated by these two tshuvas and how to compare them and contrast them. But, you know, I'm thinking a second time around, maybe I'll leave that for the second half of Shia. Because when I sent the Makomos to David Spiegel, and again, I always give him Yasher Kof for spreading and for circulating them, I started with the Nezikin aspect and the issue of compensation. So I think I'll start there. We'll try to divide up the Shia into two halves, and about halfway through the Shia, we'll discuss Kapara. Now, in this Sefer, and I've sent you many, many pages through the, taking pictures of these pages called Haviani Chadarav, which, as I mentioned in the past, has hundreds of pages of tshuvas on different situations that have arose since the outbreak of this pandemic. So in the first pages that I sent you, we have a series of tshuvas on the Nezikin from Rabbi Elchanan Peretz, who is considered the final word in Psak in Ramat Beit Shemesh. I happen to have, and probably you do as well, many family members who have taken residence in that area. And in this series, he has at least six different shilas. Maybe we'll cover, if we can, three of them. The first is about the following scenario. Someone was offered a sum of money to participate in some sort of an experimental test that could involve an element of danger. And the question is, how do we negotiate between two needs, if you will, two two sides or ends of the rope that are pulling in opposite directions. One end of the rope is Ushmartem Yodis Nafshoseichem, and a person should avoid situations in which he might endanger his life. And the other end of the pole of the rope, pulling in the opposite direction, is Parnosa. So here's a conflict which is very fascinating. If he submits and agrees to participate in this experimental procedure, then he might be exposing himself to danger, but on the other hand, he needs the money. It's Parnosa for him. Now, just as a general rule, by way of introduction, Parnosa comes into play in Halacha and Issa v'Heter as a category called B'Mokom Hefseid. And that means that if you have something which in Issa v'Heter terms is on the borderline, it's not an absolute clear-cut Avera. On the other hand, it's not a clear-cut Heter. And here's where monetary considerations and Parnosa come to the fore. And if you learn Yoredeya, for example, you'll see this left, right, and center mixtures or questions about Basa B'Cholav and B'Mokom Hefseid, we're going to be more lenient. But again, as I said at the outset, if it's clear-cut prohibition, then a person has to give up every last dime in his assets, in his bank account, in order to avoid an avera. So the author of this tshuva, who, as I said before, the Rav in Ramat Beit Shemesh, who's also the author of this entire series of tshuva about Nezikin issues that came up in contemporary post-pandemic corona history, wants to know if we can allow someone to join in this experiment for the sake of his parnosa, knowing full well that he's exposing himself to an element of danger. He opens up the tshuva, which you'll see here if you happen to have page Tuf Samach Zayin, which is the first of the pages that we circulated, with a tshuva from Chashukei Chemet, which is a sefer that's written by Rav Zilberstein Shlita that we've quoted on many, many occasions. And he in turn quotes a tshuva of the Imre Esh, which is not long ago. It's relatively modern history. And he's referring to a situation in which Jews were conscripted into the army in Hungary and in Poland, and they could sometimes wiggle their way out if they pay another Jew to show up for the draft and fill in their place. It could be that it would involve that other Jew taking on a false identity, whatever it was. So the question that was raised by the Imre Esh over a century ago was, am I allowed, for the sake of Parnosa, to hire myself out and serve in the Hungarian army, exposing myself to the dangers of war? And surprise of surprises, perhaps, at least from my perspective, the Imre Esh permits it. And this was accepted amongst many Jews. Now, he doesn't enter into the question of the various influences of the Hungarian army, issues of kashrus and so forth and so on, that he's not addressing in this tshuva. But the Imre Esh says that we find by David HaMelech that he conscripted Jewish soldiers for what's called a Milchemes Rishus. And that's a discretionary war. There's no obligation and mitzvah of milchama in these cases, and yet David HaMelech would invite Jewish soldiers and conscript them into the army to fight these battles. This, despite the fact that the Jewish soldiers obviously would expose themselves to danger. And for the sake of a Melchemes Rishus, I mean, if it was Melchemes Mitzvah, that's one thing. The Torah commands you to go out to battle. You can't claim, well, I'm exposing myself to danger. But Ribbono Shel Olam, we're talking about a Melchemes Rishus. David HaMelech decides that he wants to expand the borders of Eretz Yisrael, which is a nice thing to do, but does that justify conscripting Jewish young men to serve in the army and fight this battle, exposing themselves to danger? The very fact that David HaMelech did it means that he paskin that it was mutter. And the Reish, by process of analogy, says that if a Jew agrees for money to be conscripted to the Hungarian army, he's allowed to do so for the sake of Parnos. Now, again, if I were writing footnotes on the Imre Esh, I would wonder whether this analogy is a fair analogy. I mean, in the case of David HaMelech, Melchemes Rishus, which received the approval of the Urim V'Tumim, plus the Melech B'Yisrael, David himself, that becomes a mitzvah, although it's not a chovah, but it's certainly a mitzvah. I don't know what mitzvah there is to fight in the military service of the Hungarians or the Poles. Now, again, I know in Toronto there are the Hungarians and the Poles, so I don't want to get into that whole scene. Just kidding. But be that as it may, the Imre Esh matters it. Now, based on this tshuva of the Imre Esh, the Chashuchei Chemed wants to come to the conclusion that if a Jew exposes himself to danger for the sake of Parnosa, that's acceptable. And Parnosa is such a powerful force. So we have Parnosa versus V'nishmarta b'yodis nafshol seichem, and Parnosa trumps V'nishmarta. The author of our tshuva believes that the issue here is how dangerous is danger. And Halacha is going to approach this issue of sakana and whether or not I'm allowed to expose myself to danger from three different categories, three different definitions. And Halacha is going to be different in each one of these categories. And that's why I was fascinated by this tshuva. At the end of the day, when we come to Paskin about this experiment and whether you're allowed to participate for money, we're going to have to define which category it fits into. So what are the three categories? The first category he defines as what he calls sikun, which is danger, karov, with a miut hamotzui, and it's eino rachok. So it's karov v'eino rachok. He calls it a miut motzui. We'll try to figure out what that means, but just to translate the words, there's a certain statistical probability. Exactly what the statistical probability is, I don't know. But it's not rachok. It's a miut motzui. There's some significant chance of danger. And he says, based on a story in Gittin and a tshuva the note of Yehuda, that you're allowed to expose yourself to danger in this case of a sikun, which is karov v'eino rachok, which he defines as a miut motzui. That's the category that we're dealing with. What are his two proofs that those are permissible? One is from a story in Gittin about Reish Lakish. Reish Lakish sold himself to a clan of cannibals who would roast his body over the fire and eat his flesh. And he sold himself for that. Again, I don't know what he's going to do with the money after he's been eaten up by the cannibals. That I don't know. But anyway, he'll give it to his children. Reish Lakish, you may know, was a great warrior. And he planned and successfully implemented his plan to take over this group. They were called the Luda'im, who ate human flesh, and he killed them all and took all their possessions. But how is Reish Lakish allowed to do such a thing? It's very nice that he's a great fighter, but he exposed himself to a great danger. He was outnumbered by many. And Tosis says this was Reish Lakish before he did tshuva. After Reish Lakish did tshuva, he tried to jump over a river, which he normally could do, and he wasn't able to do it. And Rabbi Yochanan said to him, his brother-in-law, his Rebbe, said to him, Chelech lo raisa, once you have accepted the commitment to Torah, is Torah mashteshes kocho shalom. But the interesting thing is that Tosis never says that what Reish Lakish did would have been asur. But the difference is, in the language of Tosfos, whether he would be mezalzel benafshe. It was below the dignity of a human being to expose himself and sell himself to this group of cannibals. And how did Reish Lakish do such a thing? In the language of Tosfos, who zilzel biatzmo, says Tosfos, because he didn't have that same level of kavod atzmi, of self-respect, before he did tshuva. Meaning, had Reish Lakish did tshuva, he would never have sold himself to these cannibals, because it would be below his dignity to do so. There'd be a zilzul bi'atzma. So, the author of this tshuva, with a great beautiful diuk, says that Tosfos should have said that if Reish Lakish had already done tshuva, it would have been awesome for him to expose himself to this danger. Tosfos says, no, it's a zilzul bi'atzmo, and therefore the Reish Lakish would never have done such a thing. It's below his dignity. Apparently, it's not awesome. What Reish Lakish did, according to the technical, dry, legal, halachic regulations, was permissible for the sake of Parnassa. He made an awful killing on the market. Again, he could have been killed. He did a killing because he killed the Ludoyim, but he did it for the sake of money, and that's permissible. Why? Because the danger was karov. It wasn't rachok, it was a serious danger, but it was a hezek matzui. It only reaches that level of hezek matzui. Again, we have to come back and figure out what hezek matzui is. The tshuva of the Noda B'Yehuda is about hunting. Now, a person could hunt for parnasa, or he could hunt for pleasure. And when he's out there hunting wild beasts, like lions and so forth, he exposes himself to danger. He has to come pretty close to the animal in order to capture the animal. And you never know, the animal could turn around. And this has happened in South Africa. You may have heard different stories, even in Kruger Park. And it's very dangerous. So now the view that says the following. Why is he hunting? If he's hunting for the sake of pleasure, of a pastime, then it's prohibited. You're not allowed to expose yourself to danger. But if he's doing so because he needs the parnasa, he's going to sell these lions after he captures them to the zoo and make a big killing, then, says the Noda B'Yehuda, it's permissible. Again, the Baal HaTshuva wants to classify this case as a sikun rachok v'eino karov, but matzui. And he goes on to say the following, that from all these different sources, whether it's the case of joining the Hungarian army for money, whether it's the case of Reish Lakish who wants to make a big killing from the Ludoyim, whether it's the case of the Noda B'Yehuda, he's going to sell his captured animals, the Chayos Ros, to the zoo. In all these cases, it's mutter because of Parnasa, because we're talking about a case of Sikun Karov, Eino Rochok, and it's Miut HaMotzvi. Going on to the second page, if you happen to have the text, he says, however, we can have another situation of a sikun rachok. Not rachok, but rather karov and Rachok, meaning combination in this middle category of Kov and Rachok, it's Rachok. It's a very slight kind of danger. And quoting various sources, the Ralbag and the Ramchal and Mesil Sisharim, he comes to the conclusion that in the Sakana Rechoka Ma'od, where the statistical probability of death is very low, then it's a Mila will give a guy a Yashikach, and maybe he has a certain kiyum, an extra kiyum of Nishmartim Mi'odis Nafsho Seichem, but halachically, we can allow this even for the sake of pleasure, even if it's not litzorech parnos. So we now have two categories. We have a category which is called rachok ma'od, and here we only have a maila, but there's no real halachic mechayev here. And then we have another category of rachok v'eino karov, which is called a hezek matsui, and here you're not allowed to put your life into danger, but there is a heter, a leniency for the sake of parnosa. And then he goes on to the third category, which is on the other extreme. And that's a case of sakana mitsuya, which he says is shakul. It's like a 50-50 kind of situation that he might die. And in that case, it's absolutely awesome to put your life into danger. Not only that, he goes a step further. Even for the sake of saving another life, in a case where the sakana is so great, he's not obligated to do so. In the middle category, however, which we said was karov v'rachok, it's a hezek or a sakana she'eno matsui, in such a case, he says there's a chovat zehirut. He's obligated to avoid such situations, but there's no iser. He's not violating Ushmartem Yodas Nafshel Seichem, and therefore, since it's only a chovas zehirus, but not a real violation of the law, for the sake of Parnosu, will allow him to override, so to speak, to violate his chovas zehirus. And that's permissible. In a case of sakana, where somebody else's life is on the line, and if you don't jump in, he will die, then you will be in violation of both Vashivo Solo, it's a positive command, and Lo Samen Al Dam Riecha Olav, if you don't jump in, exposing yourself to danger, a danger that's Matsui V'eino Matsui, it's in that middle category. If I were to break it down into statistics, I would guess we're talking about 20 to 30%. I don't know. He doesn't define it for us. And in that category, he has a chovas zehirus, and the halacha requires him to avoid that situation, but it's not a violation of Allah. And the nafkamina is, number one, that in that middle situation, for the great need of parnasa, we're going to allow it, and that will cover the three cases of milchama b'Hungaria. And number two, the case of the hunters. And number three, the case of Reish Lakish. By the way, I don't understand why going out to battle is called Miut She'eino Matsui. I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure what percentage of soldiers never will die, you know, in the battlefield. I can't tell you. But, you know, if you'd ask me, I would say that going out to battle is a very serious danger. And for that matter, you know, exposing yourself to these Ludoyim who are meant to, you know, fry you over the fire in order to get your flesh, I would say that's also a great sakon. I agree with him that in the case of a hunter who's capturing lions and so forth, you know, he's out there trying to get the tigers and the other one out, maybe that's miut matsui, but it's not a real sakona like a 50%. In any event, that's his bottom line. And now, Joe, you wanted to say something?
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, I'm sorry. My internet's very unstable, so I'm not going to show you.
Okay. I see your name, at least, you know.
Yeah. So the last, you said the last, which was the most serious, was 50-50. That doesn't sound like it's. It sounds like the other one's much more, like you said, the army sounds a lot more stronger.
Joe, I can't help you with that. But let's take the case of a hunter. I don't know what percentage of hunters don't come back alive. They get swallowed up by lions. But I would think it's less than 20%. You know what I'm saying? Warriors, I don't know what percentage of fighters come back in a box. I don't know. Maybe it's...
But he's drawing the line at 50-50. In other words,
that's what I think, because he uses the language. Again, you have to see the text inside. I don't have time for that now, to read through this whole long tshuva. But he talks about a suffix shakul, which to me means 50-50. And in that case, he goes on to say that we're not talking about a chovas zehirus. We're talking about an absolute violation of unishmartem. It's totally illegal. And even for the sake of parnasa, that's clear-cut iser. You know, we never said behefsi beruba, you're allowed to eat basa b'chala. You have to give up the last dime in your bank account not to violate an avera. And moreover, he says, that now that it's a case of suffik hashakul, with an absolute unishmartem as an avera, then the mitzvah of vashivosalo, of saving someone's life, is completely suspended. He based himself on a tshuva of the Radbaz. And there's no iser of losamet al damriach. On the contrary, he should sit on the sidelines. Again, this has tremendous repercussions as far as lifesavers are concerned. I don't know if you remember, I don't know what rings a bell for you, but... off the beach of southern Florida, a woman was drowning, and three people, one after the other, died as a result of jumping in. You know, they were carried by a what's it called?
Undercurrent.
Undercurrent, right. Undercurrent. You mean, you could be Mark Spitz himself. You can't fight an undercurrent. And this has to do with firemen and lifesavers and policemen. I mean, there are many, many repercussions to this question. But he says, in a suffix shakul, it's absolutely usur to present yourself in that situation, and not even for the sake of hatzal. However, in the middle category, which he calls rachok v'eino rachok, which is a sakana, but it's not matzui, it's not shakul, I call the 20%. I don't know. He doesn't work it out in percentages. In that case, then it's a chova. He's obligated to avoid such a situation, but it's not a violation of an iser if he does expose himself to that danger. Hence, for the sake of parnasa, will allow it. And somehow, magically, he subcategorizes those three scenarios that we discussed in that middle category. And now, coming back to this offer that he has to join an experiment for the corona, he says that this fits into the middle category. He says, "Likanes l'maracha l'marach nisuyim rifuyim kasha sakana rechoka ein boze isur." He says, number one, it's for the sake of parnosa. He adds another element to the equation, that if, as a result of the experiment, they may discover a cure, or at least move forward in this tremendous endeavor to find a cure for this disease, he says he would have to, he'd be allowed to expose himself to that danger. Now, I don't have any tshuva that argues with him. There is no dissenting view that I can present to you, but honestly, Libi Omerli, my heart tells me that if we were to present this question to other poskim, they would be much more hesitant to give a person the okay to expose himself into danger. And if they would allow it, the overriding consideration would have to be the possibility of this experiment being successful and finding some sort of a cure. Let's go on to his second tshuva. Again, I'm just trying to gauge my time over here because, as I said, I have a lot to discuss with you about two tshuvas that seem to contradict each other as far as kapara is concerned, but we're still in the area of Nezikin. And on Tav Samach Tes, which is the very next tshuva, He asks about the following situation. The employer forces his employee to go to work with a group of people that are questionable as far as Corona is concerned. The employee, but less bravery, he has no choice because otherwise he'll lose his job. He goes and exposes himself to this group of workers. Again, it doesn't have to be a group of workers for the Shiloh to be relevant, but that's the case that he's addressing. It could be that his employer forced him to go to a certain place where we know that the corona is just spreading like wildfire, and indeed he comes down with the disease. Now, miracle of miracles, in that particular case, he survives it. He has suffered tremendously, and not only has he suffered a physical machla, which you can define as pain, you know, we could define it as pain. I remember one of my favorite people in Toronto was a pain specialist. And in addition, he suffers what he calls charada, which is psychological suffering. And you could imagine what that means in many different ways. What kind of charada? My own brother-in-law, who had the disease, he ran out of the hospital. And the Hatzolah people had to take him back in. I mean, it was just, he was so overwhelmed. But, you know, you could talk about it in many different ways. So the question is, whether or not this particular unfortunate employee can sue, in halachic terms, his employer for damages, including psychological damages. He has to pay a therapist to get him out of this state of charada. And he begins this tshuva by quoting a sefer, which he gives him a very high grade. He calls it a sefer me'uleh, an outstanding sefer called Mishpatei HaTorah. And in that sefer, he addresses this question in terms of a very famous sugya in Masechta Bava Kamma, in Perek HaChovil, and the case is where you blew a shofar in someone's ear, or any sort of blast, in a very sudden way, without giving him any, notice. And the man, in this case of Mavis Eschavero, suffers not only, perhaps from loss of hearing or some extent, but he also suffers from pachat, which we can identify with the modern Hebrew term charada. And it has an impact on his whole nefesh. So Shulchan Aruch writes, Hamavis es chavero, afal pisha chola mi pachat, potu mi dini odom, vechayev bedin shamayim. In the case of pachad, the chiyuv here is bedin shamayim. This tshuva focuses on dinei adam. What legal rights do I have to demand compensation for pachad and force the mazik to pay me up for charod, for psychological damages and fees that I have to pay for therapy? And at first glance, when you read the first paragraph of the tshuva, he's quoting this great sefer called Mishpatei HaTorah, the answer seems to be that you have no recourse to sue in such a case for compensation for damages, because he's only chayav bedin shamayim. It's only a moral obligation, not a monetary obligation that can be compelled in a Jewish human court. From this point on, having quoted the Mishpatei HaTorah, the author of the tshuva disagrees and turns it around 180 degrees. And he wants to claim that for three different reasons, the mazik, in this case the employer, would have to pay not only damages for choli, for physical ailment, but also psychological bills, you know, therapy bills. His first proof is from the Rimi Luniel, quoting the Shita Mekubetzes in that sugya in Bava Kama of Hamavis Eschavero, who says that the reason why the Mazik doesn't have to pay damages is because the Nizak should have moved his head, Hayelo Laharchines Rosho, when he saw the shofar coming. By the way, that's not Rashi. But let's talk about the Rimi Luniel. The Rimi Luniel is understanding that the reason why the Gemara and the Shulchan Aruch exempts the Mazik from payment, again, I'm talking about Dini Adam, is because there is some element of guilt, or if not Pshia, negligence on the part of the Nizak, because he could have shaked his head, he could have moved his head the other way. At least you would say he's participating in some sense, perhaps passively, to this Hezek. Because by freezing in his tracks when he could have stood up and moved over to another place, he has brought upon himself this psychological state of pachad. Obviously, if we take the really real and apply it to our case, then we're going to come to the conclusion that here's a mavis eschavero, where the pachad is sufficient grounds to force compensation that the mazik should have to pay, because the Nizak, unless he was willing to give up his job, and it seems that the premise here is that he could not give up his job, he would be starving to death, then he was absolutely forced to do so, and there was no element of negligence or participation in that situation in which he contracted the disease. And if he's ill in the hospital with corona, and he's suffering psychological difficulties, that's not his fault. We can put the entire blame on the shoulders of the ma'avid, as we call it in modern Hebrew, meaning the employer. His second source is a ktsos and the nesivus, both of whom came up independently from different sources with the conclusion that in the case of ma'avis, The reason why the mazik is potter b'dinei Adam is because there was no element of nezek. Let me explain. There's a concept in Ezekiel called grera. Grera means that one chiv could drag another. If you have a nezek gamur, for example, the physical illness that the nizak, the victim of this shofar blowing, we'll call it, suffered, that's called nezek gamur. That already equips the nizak with the monetary rights to demand compensation b'dinei adam. Then we apply grera, and even as far as grama, which is an indirect hezek, namely, in this case, the psychological damage that he suffered because of pachad and charada, he's chayav for that too. Which means that if we have nezek gamur, a complete, total nezek, and we can integrate the grama element of nezek together into one package deal with the nezek gamur, then he's chayav to pay, the mazik has to pay not only for the nezek gamur, but even for the grama. The nezek grama schleps along with it the grama as well. The hezek gamur schleps the grama. By the way, if we were learning Ezekiel, this would be a fascinating topic. I mean, it would require, you know, hours and hours of research as to how this, you know, what are the mechanics and how and when does this apply. So the tshuva here presents the thesis that having been exposed to corona and suffering physical damages as a result of this disease, that's nezeko. You talk about the psychological offshoots and the need to pay for therapy, that's already grama, that's an indirect hezek. But nevertheless, once there's hezek gamur, that hezek gamur now swallows up the grumma and he has to pay for both A plus B. His third source, which is perhaps the most revolutionary, is the Sma, the Sefer Miras Einayim. It's a classic on Choshen Mishpat. And the Sma, in two places, claims that we don't paskin like the Gemara of Grumma, namely, that Grumma is only a Chiyav B'din Shamayim, it's a moral payment. We paskin that Grumma is Chayav B'dinei Adam. And when the Gemara says that Mavis is Potter B'dinei Adam, that's because of a special reason, in which case the Mavis was he somehow should have moved, or he should have done this, he should have done that. He brought the Nezek upon himself. And therefore, the Bala Tshuva here, this Rav Peretz, writes that Benidon Didan, in our case, Hanizak Lo Haya Yochol, he didn't have the potential of Loli Boel. Notice at the moment of Hezek, you know, he was in a state of Bahala because he suffered so tremendously from Corona, and therefore the Taina of Grumma is no longer a Taina. So again, we're going to reject the Taina of Grumma for three different possible reasons. Just to review. Reason number one is based on the Rimi Nulunil, that the reason why he's Potter is because there was some element of participation, or albeit in a passive way, he could have avoided the shofar. Then we add the Greira Svara of the Ktsos and the Nesivis, namely that if he's Chayev and Ezek Gomor, the Mele he's Chayev for Grum as well. And finally, the Shita of the Sma, that all these Gemaras that seem to indicate that Grum is Potter B'Didi Adam are not accepted L'Halacha. And in each case, we're going to have to find a reason, an exceptional reason, why the Gemara says that Grum is pot. Umeata, as he concludes, on Daf Tuf Ayin, if you have the pages, Nimtza she shalosh sibos lechayavis amazik benidon didan, al hotzos hatipula psychologi, we have three different reasons to obligate the mazik, in this case the employer, to pay compensation for psychological therapy. And then he adds a fourth reason of his own. And he says that in our day and age, when a person suffers a hezek and he enters into a state of shock and fear, then it's automatic in our society that we send him for psychological therapy. It's almost built into the hezek itself. Back in the day of the Talmud, maybe they didn't have that mitzvah, that situation, but today our situation is such that when a person suffers a serious injury, a profound machla, then it's almost automatic that when we send him various people of to give him therapy, we will send him a psychological therapist. And therefore it's really built in to the hezek itself. Now, Rabosai, honestly, again, you know, I always give my little comments. I don't understand the whole tshuva. The whole thing makes no sense to me. The Gemara of Grumma, in the case of Mavis, is addressing a case of a Maisa Hezek. It's part of the sugi of Hachovel B'Chavero. If I blow a shofar suddenly into your ears, that's called a chavola. The sound waves coming out of the shofar are like the blows if I hit you over the head, pardon the expression. That's not what's going on over here. Our case over here is where an employer sends his employee into the lion's den. Well, maybe the employer was wrong for doing so, I have no question. But did he know that this was a lion's den? Was he absolutely sure that his employee would be exposed to this negev? And furthermore, it's pure grumma. This is not a maisa hezek. So to apply the logic of the chachmei luniel, of the rimi luniel, and say, well, you know what? Only if he could have avoided it. He was a participant. Forget it. Even the Rimi Luniel is going to admit that this is a case of Grum. And then to add the Ktsosa and the Nesivus with Greira, what relevance does that have? Greira means when there was an actual Maisa Hezek, Adam Mur, the Olam Adam Amazik, and now there was a Grumma element, and we sweep them all together and integrate them. But here, where's the Nezek Gomor? Just because I sent you to work in very difficult and challenging situations in which you will expose yourself to this danger, that's called Nezek Gomor. The whole thing is Gomor. And guess what? I call this Hodas Bal Din. In the very last paragraph of this tshuva, he writes the following. V'afal gav di'ena nezek ze biyodayim. Like Boker Tov. Like all of a sudden he wakes up out of a reverie and he tells you that this is not a hezek biyodayim. Nevertheless, he should be paying up. Why? Because hamakubalhu l'shalem alkach. Hamekubal hu l'shalem alkach. Five words. And that's what I call minag hamedina. If you're familiar with Nezikin, one of the elements in Nezikin is tikkun hamedina. Again, whether that applies to Medinas Yisrael or not, that's, you can go and debate that. But I would assume right now that Medinas Yisrael is no worse than any other Medina on the face of the earth, and there's something called Tikkun HaMedina. So if in the state of Israel, an employer who exposes his employee to difficult situations is going to have to pay damages, and even for psychological therapy and so forth, so why not say that from the get-go? I mean, you know, the whole issue here is whether or not you can force someone to compensate somebody else according to the law of the land. You know, if you're learning, for example, the beginning of Baba Basra, this concept comes up all the time. You know, he put up a wall between the two chatzeros, two batim, you know, Hezekriah and all this stuff. And the Gemara says it really depends on Midin HaMedina. So all of a sudden he says, Hamakubalu l'shalem alka. He admits that the whole tshuva, part of the expression is bupkis, and the reason why he has to pay when it's a case of grama is because it's mekubal alka. And he writes l'sikum, and he summarizes this, he writes, Yeshet tzadei l'chayev hachove l'shalom tipul psychologi, im zeo seder haripui haragil. In other words, if this is the way a person goes through therapy, and he says that, you know, they should work out a pshara maybe, that he should pay some of the fees and other of the fees. Very, very strange. But in any event, I think it's a fascinating tshuva, and it's worthy of our study. Okay, let me put this on the side again. I'm going to ask David if he doesn't mind sending out these Mar Makomos next week as well, because we still have a lot to do. But I'd like to dedicate the rest of the Shia to the question of Kapara. And here I have two tshuvas from the same author. And that is Rav Weiss, Rav Asher Zelig Weiss. One tshuva is published in an anthology of his tshuvas, which is called Yerech Eitanim Bidan Karona. And we're looking at Simon Tes Vav. And it's called Darki Tshuva Lachot Shebishkaga Gormal Movet Lechole. Now, he's writing this tshuva to the Machanech who educated and raised a young Jewish religious girl. She's now 22 years old. She's an outstanding nurse. You know, nurses get different dargas. She's on the highest darga. And she was called at the outbreak of this pandemic to a great hospital in New York. I suspect I know which hospital it is. He doesn't mention it by name. He calls it Beit Cholim Gadol in New York. And it's at the epitome of this pandemic. He says there are thousands and tens of thousands of Chole Corona. Now, I don't know what he means by this. I suspect when he says tens of thousands, he's referring to the entire United States of America. I don't know. Bobby, I don't hear you. You have to unmute yourself. Be that as it may, after a full shift of probably, it's hard to say, but maybe 12 hours, maybe 14 hours, the hospital is understaffed. They're flooded by real critically dangerous pages. And she's about to go home exhausted from the night's work, day and night. And the Menahel of this entire machlaka, because she's an expert on breathing issues, he calls upon her and begs her. He says, we have understaffed. I need you for another shift. About 20 hours into the shift, meaning 12 and another 8 hours, I don't know. He says at 3 in the morning, they bring in a chole who is hovering between life and death. He's grasping at every air, every breath of air. And at this point, she's absolutely exhausted, and she makes a mistake. Now, it's not clear to me exactly what her mistake is. There are three different phrases here, which I'll read to you, and maybe you can tell me what exactly she did wrong. But at the end of the day, this chola dies. And she is in a state in which she is so psychologically impacted with guilt. She can't sleep nights. She wakes up crying. She's so jealous of her friends who went to seminary with her because they're doing tshuva because maybe at one time perhaps they spoke Lashon Hara or maybe they didn't treat their bubbies the right way. And she is doing tshuva for having been responsible for the death of someone. Instead of saving a life, which is like saving the whole world, it's called Ma'abe Nefesh Achas Mishrael, it's Ki'ilu, it's as if he destroyed the whole world. She's beside herself, she can't live. Now, exactly what her mistake was is very relevant to me personally, because I'm going to show you that in a different tshuva, by the same author, Rav Weiss, he comes down very harsh on someone who causes the death of someone else in this pandemic unintentionally. So what exactly did she mess up? So I'm going to read to you three phrases here. If you have the tshuva in front of you, David sent it out to you. And I can't exactly get my handle on it. First, he writes that b'ta'ut, she was so exhausted that mistakenly hichlifa bein hatzinorot, like she put the wrong pipe into the man's breathing, or maybe into the wall or into the machine. I don't know. It sounds to me like this is a pretty serious error. I mean, she didn't even attach him to a ventilator. She got the wrong pipes. But then he says, lo chibra oto kifi atzorech. It sounds like she did attach him to a ventilator, but it was loose. And she didn't make sure to guarantee the fasten in a very tight way his body to this machine. Then he has a third phrase here that, because there was a limit in this hospital at that moment of ventilators, they imported other kinds of ventilators that were not dedicated for service in a hospital. They were old, outmoded ventilators that are meant to be used in homes. And the tzevet, the staff of the hospital, had no clue exactly how to use these ventilators. V'lo ayu mukarim l'tzevet beit hacholim. And this is what her mistake was. Now it sounds like her mistake was that although she did connect him to a ventilator, but it was the wrong ventilator because the hospital had imported these ventilators that were not reliable. And again, if you ask me, there are three phrases here to describe her mistake, and it's all based on the letter that she wrote. And they sound, honestly, like three different stories. I don't know exactly what the nature of a mistake is. If she put the wrong pipe in, you know, that's one kind of a mistake. If she failed to connect him to a ventilator, you know, that's something that we have to reckon with. If on the other end she, you know, and maybe she was, okay, so she did connect him to a ventilator, but she didn't do it properly. She didn't fasten it. That's already a lower level. It's not chiluf hatzinoros. And then on the third level, she connects him to a ventilator, but it was the wrong ventilator because there's such confusion about which ventilators are really functional. Until finally the man is grasping for air. She wakes up and she realizes, oh no, what do I do? I made a big mistake. She changes him and attaches him to the right ventilator, and the man dies. And she can't live with us. And the whole tshuva here of Rav Weiss, it's a beautiful tshuva. Again, I've been reading Rav Weiss now for quite a few months. And I think I mentioned to you, we're a little bit mishpacha, so to speak. You know, his brother is married to my wife's cousin, my wife's first cousin. And it's a beautiful tshuva. Tanuach daita shel tzadekes zu v'tischazek rucha. He says, let her friends be, how should I say, involved and psychologically tormented by guilt because of some possibility of lashon hara, they didn't take good care of the bubby. This woman is such a tzadekes. She's involved and dedicated Yom of Elila to save Jewish lives. She probably saved tons of Jews. Kima olamos. She has kept up worlds, because each Jew is a world in himself. And in this case, Hashem ino liyadot, happened to be that she may have made a mistake and was responsible for the death of a person. And he quotes the Ramban, he calls him Adonenu HaRamban in Torah Sa'adam, where the Ramban writes that Chas V'Shalom, that a person should think twice about becoming a doctor. You know, the Ramban and many other Rishonim in his time were physicians. And thinking, why should I get involved in being a doctor when I might cause the death of someone? He says, no. On the contrary, you have to do the best you can, save lives to the best of your ability, and if b'shogeg somebody dies, then ein alav onesh klal, there's no punishment whatsoever. And v'rapo yirape means that the Torah is telling you to get involved in medicine, do the best you can. On occasion, we're all human beings, you may fail to do the best job possible, but this is your holy calling. And he says that the Ramban writes called Rofe Sheodea Malachazu Chayev Hularapos. It's not just a Rishus, as the Gemara seems to indicate, that he has license to serve as a physician, but he's obligated to do so. Vimonea Atzmo Hareze Shofech Domin. So, of course, a Rofe has to be very, very careful. He's got human life in his hand. He's a shliach of Hashem, but he's involved in the most glorious occupation of saving olamos. And he says that all our discussion revolves around a case of horeg b'shogeg. You know, the Torah is very harsh about ritzicha b'shogeg, and you have to go to an ir miklat. But he says here, this is not a rotzeach. This is a situation in which she failed to give hatzolah, mistakenly so. That's not the same as causing someone's death or murdering someone. And he says, this tos gives her the status of ones gomer. These are circumstances out of her control. And therefore, all of those stringencies and chumras and punishments and requirements of kapara that apply to a horig nefesh b'shkoga have no application here in this case. She is absolutely involved in doing the best she could do to fulfill the mitzvah ashivosolo and to avoid the lotas of lotamen al damriecha. Ein oleha shum onish klal. And since she did the best that she could, and she was totally dedicated to self-sacrifice for the sake of Hatzola, but just the weight on her shoulders was too great, in such a case, Vadai, says Rav Weiss, Ein Aleh Shum Chet V'Avon V'Shum Onish Klal, she doesn't need tshuva. He goes on to add a piece of his own. This is his own personal vendetta, his agenda. And he says, if anyone has to do tshuva here, if anyone needs a chesed nefesh and has to recite vidu on an aver biyado, it's not the rofim, and it's not the achiot, it's not the nurses that are giving their all in self-sacrifice in conditions that are above human conditions, but rather it's those people who he calls the begaivas libam, ubesichlus rosham, mezalzalim bahoras harofim. They're careless about the requirements, and they really are the ones who have to do tshuva because they are garmim lispashtus hamagefa, sherabim chalolim hipil. And again, this may sound a little bit, you know, on deaf ears if you're in Toronto of Canada, which we call the green country, but here, situation's not good. I mean, we've been in lockdown. I'm not going to go into details with the numbers, but well over 2,000 Jews have died here in this country, and the number of critical patients is astronomical. It's probably over 1,000. So we don't realize so that it could very well be that a person will be a carrier and infect others when he himself, the carrier, has little, if any, symptoms. But the other person who's infected, unfortunately, might not fare as well. And therefore, those are the people who have to do tshuva. Now, I know that officially our time has run out, so it's up to you if you want to stay another few minutes, but here I become very perplexed. Because in the Sefer that I began with, which is called Haviani Chadarav, there's a tshuva from the same author of Usher Zelig Weiss, B'mishe Goram Lemoves Adam. We're talking about a case part of the staff of, what's the word I'm looking for, the medical staff. And he was assigned to a nursing home. And as you and I know, the nursing homes are very, very vulnerable to very dangerous situations, chas v'shalom, of corona. And what happened was that one of the members of this person's family tested positive, chola b'corona, but he himself felt perfect. He felt good. He didn't have any fever or any other symptoms. And he played the major role in the staff, in the medical staff, in this particular nursing home. He made a decision that even though he was exposed to a member of his family that was infected, he would nevertheless show up in the nursing home. He came to work wearing everything that he had to wear. Nakat emtza'ei zehirut hamekubalim. He lived up to the standards and the requirements and even beyond. You know, you can imagine the suit and the whole business. And days later, he found out that he himself is infected. And a number of people, unfortunately, in the nursing home came down with the disease. Now again, it's never crystal clear that they came down with the disease because of him. He felt good. There was an omes, there was a weight upon his shoulders to show up in the nursing home, despite the fact that he was exposed to a family member who had been infected. He himself felt great. And as I said, he protected himself and the members of the nursing home, the patients, as best as he could. But at the end of the day, the assumption is, we're not sure, but he was the carrier that infected some of the members of the nursing home, and some of them passed away. Hitvarer sha'od ovdim chalu v'lo bar mi'ed bikesmi. As the story develops, it could be there were other workers who worked in the same nursing home who were also likewise infected. So we don't know who infected the people in the nursing home. But he thinks that he's guilty. Because since he was exposed to a member of his family, he should not have gone to work, even though he was absolutely necessary and critical in the nursing home. Ha'ish shavur, he's absolutely broken up. Viratzutz, he's running around, he can't contain himself. Humevakish is nafsho b'sheiloso, he writes and asks us, b'mei yechupar avon, give me a method of kapara. What should I take upon myself to atone for this terrible sin? V'keitzad biyado limtzo slicha v'kapara. Now, having read the tshuva of the achot that we spoke about before, that nurse who's 22 years old, who took upon herself, at the insistence of the Merahel HaMachalka, that she would take another shift after she was totally exhausted, but betos she was responsible for the death of someone. Here's a person where the weight of responsibility vis-a-vis this nursing home is on his shoulders. He took every measure that he could, even though he felt great. He had no reason to suspect that he was infected. And yet, as things turned out, he was infected. I'm not sure, Rabosai, and please help me figure this all out. What exactly is the difference between the two cases? Meaning, the answers are going to be totally different. Radically different from the same nation. As we'll soon see. And if you ask me, who is more worthy of requiring kapara, I'm not sure which way I would go. And part of my confusion is because I'm not clear about the facts on the ground with regard to that nurse. I mean, if she put in the wrong plugs, the wrong tzinorot, that, or if she didn't adjust the ventilator properly, again, she's exhausted and I certainly have nothing against her, but there is some element here of negligence. This fellow, I'm not sure. On the one hand, he has no symptoms. He's feeling great. Number two, he takes all the precautions that are necessary, lives up to all the regulations. Number three, we're not even sure that he's the one who's responsible for the histabkut, that the infection spread. And yet, Rav Weiss spends 4.5 pages listing the types of kapara and the actions that he has to take upon himself. In fact, at one point, he quotes a tshuva of the Ma'ariv Vayil. I mean, just to give you a flavor for what goes on over here, Ma'ariv Vayil, and he quotes other poskim in different scenarios, different situations wherein unintentionally they cause the death of someone else. He has a Maram Milublin and others. Number one, he should fast for 40 days consecutively. And this is during Corona. Number two, he should fast every week for the rest of his life, 3 days out of every week. Number four, he should never eat meat, never drink wine or beer, even on the nights between one fast day and another. Then he says he should not sleep on pillows or comfortable mattresses, with the exception of Shabbos and Yontif. Then he says he should never wash his entire body. He should never shampoo his hair. Once in a month, he can shampoo his hair. He can sleep, if he wants to, under the entranceway to his house or the entranceway into the Beis HaKnesses. And for one full year, he should be davening outside the Beis HaKnesses. once a month, he should visit the kever of that person that he unintentionally was responsible for his death. And he should never participate in a Suda Simcha. He should never go out on any Tiulim for the sake of pleasure. And every 3 years he should fast Bahab. It goes on and on, Rabbos. I don't even want to tell you all the gory details. Now, what was the case that was being addressed? A man's daughter was up for judgment in the Rav's house for an accusation of her doing a certain avera. Her father was afraid that the Rav was going to paskin against her with a harsh punishment. So he runs to the door of the Rav in order to plead the case of his daughter. The Rav thinks that the father is coming to beat the living daylights out of him. Apparently the Rav was an elderly gentleman, I'm not sure, that's not indicated. And the Rav lifts up a very heavy piece of furniture in order to close the door so that this man, the father of the daughter who's being judged inside, would not be able to come into his house because the Rav thought that this man was coming to beat the living daylights out of him, which was the last thing from his mind. He was just coming to plead the case of his daughter and ask for compassion. And this man caused the death of the Rav. The Rav, as a result of lifting this very heavy thing to close the door, ended up in bed, and 3 days later he died. And this man has to go through this entire list. And Rav Weiss says that, okay, in our case, maybe it's not the same level of responsibility, but he says, nevertheless, he has to take upon himself a system of kapara. He says, "Nira lechalik ben shnei matzavim, and ze shekefia nireh." We think we're not sure. Hidbik acherim b'machla. He says this is not a real full fudge pshia. Lo yada. He had no way of knowing that he was infected. We're not even sure if he infected the people in the nursing home. And he says, what should he do? He was osik b'mitzvah. He was really trying to do great mitzvah. Lefichach, he says, ein lahachmir olav. What does that mean? Yis'ana b'chol erev rosh chodesh. He should fast once a month on erev rosh chodesh. V'yomar yom kippur katan b'meshach shona rishona. And he says, yikabal al atzmo limud, a special learning session. And he says that when he fasts, if he finds it very difficult to fast, then he should fast at least until Chatzos Hayom. Yikabal atzmo limud le'ilui nishmas hamniftarim yarbe bitzdaka. And im mishpachos haniftarim, and if those who died in that nursing home are aniyim, then he should be supporting their families. At the end he writes, "Vehu rachum yichaper avon." May the Lord in heaven grant this man atonement. Unbelievable. At the end of the tshuva, he says, to add to his hope for atonement, he says he should be misnadev, he should be the first to volunteer in the mitzvah of Bikur Cholim, in the mitzvah of Nichum Avelim. He should continue and give extra energy towards Hatzolos Nefoshos, Vehu Racham Yichaper. What a different tshuva in its entire essence, its whole spirit, than the tshuva that he himself writes to this Achot, who again, I'm not sure exactly where she messed up, but possibly she never actually attached this man who's grasping for his last breath of air to a ventilator. Again, I don't hold her responsible, chas v'sholem. She was exhausted. She made a human mistake. But to quote the Ramban and lachazik es rucha, that she's the tzaddikus of our generation, and she doesn't need any kapara whatsoever. On the contrary, We should be praising her as the greatest. And this guy, who had no symptoms, felt great, was wearing all the gear that he needed. He had the prime responsibility in that nursing home, made a decision that he would go, take every precaution, as we said before. We're not even sure if he was responsible for passing this infection. And the spirit, and the, again, I didn't read 4.5 pages to you, is all kapara, 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 fast and fast, and roll in the snow. I mean, don't take me literally. I just felt that I wanted to share this with you because I was very perplexed, and I was hoping that maybe you would help me. Bobby? But you gotta unmute yourself, because I've been watching your lips move the whole shiur, Bobby. Every 5 minutes, I'm saying to you, Bobby, please turn on, unmute your thing, because I don't know who you're talking to. I can't even hear you. Can't hear you. Let's see. Maybe I can unmute you. Let's see. One second, Bobby. Hold on there.
He got muted himself.
He should be able to do it himself, no? Yeah. I mean, I never muted anybody in a way that
Maybe his microphone is off.
Bobby, your microphone is off. I mean, you could try me on hand language, sign language, but I'm not an expert on sign language.
Maybe you can make a chat out of it. You put a chat? Is that possible?
The only thing I could suggest, Bobby, is either I call you or you call me and I'll put you on loudspeaker.
Disconnected. Maybe I'll reconnect.
Maybe. All right, Rabosa. I don't want to hold you up as it is. I went over time. We'll stop here. And it's food for thought. There's a lot of things that we covered today that are really fascinating and challenging if you have a chance to think about them. And B'li Neder, we'll see each other next Wednesday. Thank you very, very much. So Rabosai, I couldn't hear the answer of Bobby, and as I said before, we'll have to say goodbye right now, and I find it a little bit sensitive here to try to find the nuances or the differences between the two cases of unintentional murder or possibility of the loss of life, and please, if you can, think about it. Bobby, we waited for you, we tried to see if you could connect with us. I don't know why the technology didn't work in this case, but as I said before, thank you very much, and Emirat Hashem, we'll see each other next Wednesday. And wishing everyone to have a healthy week.